You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar. Chances are you don't know this movie.
We will have no more of that. I'm not one of your barroom tarts.
You're right, teacher. You're 100% right. I've been a bad boy. I've been naughty. Matter of fact, I don't even belong in your class.
That's Frank Sinatra and Martha Heyer in Vincent Minnelli's Some Came Running. It's director Richard Linklater's pick for the best film you've never seen. The best film you've never seen is also the title of a new book by Chicago writer Robert K. Elder, featuring interviews with Linklater and 34 other directors about the movies they adore that have been critically reviled, forgotten, or otherwise overlooked. On this week's Film Spotting, I talk with Elder about his new book, and Josh and I share our own overlooked picks as we revisit a former Film Spotting top five. That's ahead on Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting, and I know Josh and I had promised that we would give you our review of Before Midnight this week, along with our top five Americans abroad. Unfortunately, some scheduling conflicts have forced us to put that off. Instead, we'll help program your very own Overlooked Movie Festival as we revisit our May 2012 top five Overlooked films a bit later in the show. But first, my conversation with writer Robert K. Elder about his brand new book, The Best Film You've Never Seen. Conversations with 35 directors about the movies they love that no one else does. Robert, it's so great to have you back on the show.
Adam, thanks for having me.
The last time you were here, of course, we were talking about your previous book, The Film That Changed My life, 30 directors. Here you've upped the ante a little
bit. Yes, we've added a few. We've
35.
Added a few, yeah.
I am curious where the inspiration for this came from. Was it a particular interview that you did and you thought, okay, I could compile these and I could do more of these. This is really fascinating stuff. Or was this just more part of something I know that you are really interested in exploring, which is this notion of epiphanies?
Sure. It was a little bit of both of that, but more it was trying to recreate those conversations you have with friends who mm-hmm. also love films. It's trying to recreate that moment when you see something on late night TV or you're caught by surprise and then you sort of share that love. And often those films are not films that are classics. And so what I wanted to do is approach these directors and basically say, hey, let's rewrite film history. What film do you love that's been, you know, critically savaged that you think needs attention, that needs an audience?
Mm-hmm. And true to the title, I have only seen four of the films
oh, really?
That came up
oh, really?
In this book. So there are many films here that I haven't seen. The four I have seen, Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, F for Fake, the Orson Welles film, Breaking Away, and Le Samurai. One of the things I know that came up with your previous book was that you had a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm. You had some directors who picked the same film, and right. you'd expect this because some of them are very big classic films. They picked the same movie they wanted to talk about. The movie that changed their life was Citizen Kane or The Godfather or Fellini's 8½. And you had to convince a few of them to go to your second choice. I'm guessing you didn't have that overlap with this one.
No, there was no danger at all. You know, Guillermo del Toro choosing this sort of rare Mexican film that he couldn't even find a copy of, The Arcane Sorcerer. John Waters picked Boom. Arthur Hiller picked The Iceman Cometh, which was sort of the later Lee Marvin version. Very, very little chance of overlap. And it was great because it allowed me to hunt down some films that I had never had a chance to see or had never even heard of. Like Alex Proyas loved The Swimmer. And mm-hmm. who's ever heard of The Swimmer?
I had not.
Yeah.
one of the things I found really fascinating, and I'll confess, I did not read every single interview for a very good reason, though, Robert, and that is having admitted now to not seeing 31 of these films, not that they go too much into spoiler territory, some more than others, but I just don't like to read anything about a movie before I see it. So I danced around some of the interviews a little bit, and I did think it was interesting that you still had to define it a little bit with some of these directors, and you had some debates with a few of them, like Richard Linklater and Kevin Smith in particular, about whether or not these really qualified as underseen movies or overlooked movies. We do that here all the time on Film Spotting with our top fives, trying to define those kind of abstract things.
Well, and yeah, I really, really wanted them to be obscure. I mean, I wanted to have to go on the gray market and find this film. You know, I wanted to, and because the impetus for when I started this book, you know, 7-8 years ago, was to get some of these films on DVD. And now DVD is becoming a format that's sort of going away. So, you know, it was very interesting. So Kevin Smith picked A Man for All Seasons, which swept the Oscars.
Yeah. But best picture.
Yeah, yeah. But he stuck up for it, and he basically said, you know, that makes it even more tragic because no one talks about it. No one under 30 has seen it. No one cites it anymore. For Richard Linklater, Some Came Running, which is a film that by some it's considered the first Rat Pack film, he said, this is a great understated Frank Sinatra performance. It's Sinatra at his greatest, and no one talks about it.
Right.
So I sort of let them define it, but I did push back.
I like that. And I think that ultimately you were right to allow them that leeway, because I agree with a movie like A Man for All Seasons. It is still underseen, I think, by a lot of people of a younger generation. And I'm a little bit younger than Kevin Smith, and it's one of those films I've always been embarrassed that I've never seen. So seeing it appear in the book just made me feel even more shame and want to finally catch up with that film. So many great performers.
Well, there's
movie.
Only so many hours in a day. Like,
there
that's,
are.
That's the other thing.
Thank you. Thank you for acknowledging that, Robert. I don't think my listeners sometimes fully appreciate that. Clearly, you can learn a lot from any filmmaker, any artist you're talking to when you go back and talk to them about the films that were epiphanies for them. Like the film that changed their life, that first movie that they really became aware of the cinematic experience, or they became aware of the fact that, hey, I'd like to do this for a living. Do you think, having now done this book, you actually learn a little bit more or get a little bit more insight into what makes some of these filmmakers tick when you consider the gems, the obscure gems that they really want to champion, because you're not picking anything that other people are enamored with, like The Godfather or Annie Hall or whatever the film might be? These really are movies that speak particularly to them, and maybe only to them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you really get that, especially with Bill Condon, you know, who directed Dreamgirls and Twilight. You know, he talks about Sweet Charity, which is this famous flop made with Shirley MacLaine in the title role that has a great couple of scenes in it. It's Bob Fosse's first film, but he talked about just the disappointment of going to see it and being all riled up, and it just went nowhere. And he compared, you know, himself, you know, he said, you know, as a young gay man, it was like Star Wars for me, and no one else cared.
Yeah. Yeah. So it clearly does show what spoke to him at that young age and informs his work now. It's really interesting stuff. I think as well, something that jumped out to me was how much nostalgia seemed to inform a lot of the picks. And Jonathan Levine in particular, he's the director who made The Wackness and recently Warm Bodies. He talks about the movie Can't Stop the Music, the Village People movie, which again, I have not seen. But after reading your interview with him and hearing him talk about the film, I have to admit, I really do want to finally catch up with this film. But he says it here: I went to film school, and I do not have a hugely vast knowledge of film, but I've seen a decent amount of movies. And no matter how I try to have the really great classic films influence me, it's the ones I saw on TV when I was 8 that have more of an impact on who I am and what I want to do as a filmmaker, for better or worse. I thought that was really interesting because it informs so much of what I do here on the show and my top five list. Sometimes you just can't shake those movies you saw when you were 8 or 10 or 12 years old. And that seemed to recur a lot with some of your subjects here.
I think so, but I don't think nostalgia is the right word. I think nostalgia is sort of when you look back and you try to sort of imbue something with warmth that it didn't have. I think what you get is basically your director trying to chase the dragon. They saw something that turned them on, or just sort of, you know, one of my directors talks about this film, Ivan's Ecstasy, that Joe Swanberg picked. And he talked about how this film, when he saw it, just like dug a hole in his brain. So it was one of these things that he couldn't let go of. So it's them sort of trying to project this love of this film and this experience out to, you know, readers and listeners in our case.
Yeah.
For them, it's trying to recapture that initial moment.
One of the things that I was especially struck by reading that chapter about Can't Stop the Music, and I think what drew me to that one is I said, oh, I'll never see this movie, the Village People movie. That doesn't interest me at all. But after hearing him talk about it, it not only sounded so crazy, but just being reminded of the story of the actual village people mm-hmm. and how that group was kind of constructed, it made me realize that I'd actually like to see a movie that is the actual village people movie. I want to see the story that really is about them. Don't you think that would be a movie someone should make if they haven't already?
And yeah, and you kind of get that. You kind of get that. I mean, the really interesting thing about that film and Jonathan's choice to champion that film is that it, I think it was the first movie that won the Razzies. It like swept right. the Razzies. But also, it's a film that is a time capsule because they're at the end of the 70s. They film it, I think, in 79. It comes out in 80s.
Right.
The Village People are done, basically,
by disco's
then.
Pretty much over.
Yeah. And they even the guy who is the lead singer is not even in the movie. Like, the guy who sings YMCA it has left the group. And there's this weird sort of like optimism, and Steve Guttenberg is the star, and he, you know, they keep trying to prove themselves to the audience. They're like, it's a whole new thing. It's the mm-hmm. it's the 80s. And for that reason, you can't help but love the enthusiasm, even though you know what happened.
Yeah.
It's the musical extravaganza that launches the 80s. It's Alan Carr's Can't Stop the Music.
You can't stop the music.
Once you see it, you'll know why you can't stop the glamour.
Before you sat down to do these interviews and knew what film they were going to talk about, and obviously you had to do your research mm-hmm. and see them in preparation for the interview, how many of them had you seen? Do you remember?
I had seen, boy, nobody's asked that question yet. I had seen maybe five.
Okay.
Maybe
so about
five.
The same
yeah.
as me. So you had to do a lot of work here to get up to speed with these movies. Which one would you say of the 35 was the biggest discovery for you? The one that you look back to and say, if anything, doing this book was worth it just so I got a chance to see this movie that I maybe otherwise wouldn't have seen.
There are two, actually.
Okay.
One is Orson Welles' F for Fake.
Yeah.
Like this amazing sort of film that I think is sort of buried in his canon, and it's kind of not even a traditional film, but really, really amazing. Henry Jaglom, who is a friend of his and had also directed Orson later in his life, championed that one. And then the other one is this film called 10 Rillington Place, which Sean Durkin, who directed
Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
Yes, thank you for doing that for me. just told me about, and it's the serial killer film directed by Richard Attenborough. It's got John Hurt in it, and Attenborough himself plays the serial killer, and it is chilling.
Really?
Like, I'm still sort of haunted by it.
That's interesting. And F for Fake is a movie, as I said, one of the ones I have actually seen. I think it came up here on the show the first time back when I talked to writer-director Ryan Johnson, who's in the book, mm-hmm. about his movie The Brothers Bloom, because we did a show all about con men, and that film definitely came up in Ryan's top five, I think maybe mine as well. So I'm glad that Ryan kind of pushed me to catch up with that movie finally. What about the film where you watched it and you recognized that, wow, I just had a completely different experience with this movie than the director? Was there any case where someone almost had to convince you the movie was good and you saw it and just thought, okay, really, that's the movie you're picking?
Well, some of them. But the thing that helped me get over that was because they loved it, it made me love it.
Okay.
It made me love it through their eyes. I mean, there are a couple that I had a harder time with, and I think I would be doing a disservice to those films by naming them. But I think you get the enthusiasm and, again, the deep affection these directors have for these, what Bill Condon calls orphan films.
Mm-hmm. You know I'm not going to let you off the hook. Come on. I think you gotta come clean. What are the movies that maybe you found yourself wrestling with what the possible allure was here, or just that you found maybe challenging sits?
Well, the Brothers Quay talked to me for this film, and I love the Brothers Quay, but they've picked this Bokanowski film called Angel, or The Angel, L'Ange, and it is a film that I think should be sort of like in a gallery somewhere, sort of repeating and playing over, because it's these beautiful images, but it is challenging. You know, the same thing could be said of Orson Welles' The Trial. Frank Oz picked that film, and he's right. You know, as a piece of entertainment, it's tough, but it is so hard-hitting. It hits you right in the gut.
What about a pick that you found surprising based on who the director was? Maybe you have certain expectations, and you could kind of predict or try to predict what movie they may be fascinated by for this book and what movie they'd want to discuss, and then you heard the one they chose, and you thought, really? That's the film?
Yeah, that would be Can't Stop the Music.
Okay.
I mean, it really would. I mean, another one would be, Kevin Smith picking A Man for All Seasons. But that actually fits.
I mean,
because he's, you know, devoutly Catholic. He has this love for language. that sort of fits, but only sort of in retrospect.
Right. I'll confess that I didn't expect that. You're right. Maybe that's the one that I was most struck by as a surprise, because you think of Kevin Smith and you think of him more as this kind of vulgar writer and whatnot, even though I'm a fan of a lot of his films, and you don't think of this stately British period piece as the movie he'd choose. But then again, that is fascinating to hear him talk about how he was hooked by that film. That was a movie that he saw as a younger man. So not necessarily a nostalgia case and that he's trying to imbue it with that warmth you talked about, but just as a young man, it spoke to him in some really fascinating way. It made me think that for me, and I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you what the film would be for you if you had been a subject in this book, the movie for me probably would have been the film The World According to Garp.
Oh, really?
Which did get 2 Oscar nominations, so you might argue with me about it.
I think it's a great film. I think, not enough people have seen it.
But not enough people have seen it. Yeah. Early 80s Robin Williams movie, I think it gets kind of overlooked. George Roy Hill, who did Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid, and some other great films. But I don't think it's one a lot of people know. I find people all the time who aren't familiar with it at all. And actually, a connection to your book, John Irving, the author, co-wrote it with Steve Tesich, who wrote, of course, Breaking Away, which is one of the choices here in the book. But what about you? What's the film that maybe you go back to and you'd point to as the one that you think more people absolutely need to see?
There are a couple of them. And actually, what this book allowed me to do was talk to some of those directors. There's a film called The Americanization of Emily, which is a Paddy Chayefsky film.
Yeah.
And it's directed by Arthur Hiller. And Arthur Hiller has had this amazing career. I mean, he directed Love Story and The Silver Streak, and just this really interesting career. He also directed The Hospital, which is another Paddy Chayefsky script. But that I was just knocked out by.
Really?
Oh, yeah, James Garner, and just such a sort of amazing stuff. And then there are things that are even more obscure. There's a film I love from 2000 that was directed by Henry Brummel, and he was largely known as the director of the TV series Homicide. It's called Panic, and it's got William H. Macy in it and Donald Sutherland, and basically they're 2 generations of hitmen.
Okay.
And I saw it, and I actually reviewed it for the Chicago Tribune and was so sort of dazed by it. I gave it 4 stars, and I came in and talked to my editor, and they're like, what, 4 stars, really? And I stuck up for it. I was like, no, this is a masterpiece. And came back, you know, that Friday when all the reviews are printed, and Roger Ebert also gave it 4 stars.
Really?
And they were like, oh, okay, fine.
Pretty good company then.
Yeah, it was good company. And I have to say, Roger, you know, before he passed away, was very, very nice and endorsed the book. And he was always supportive, not only of me, but of overlooked films in general. You know, he has a whole festival.
Ebert Fest.
Yeah.
You're right. It's all predicated on that.
Yeah. So it's these kind of conversations, even when they're contentious, that I love.
As Sheila would say, it's too bloody lovely, really it is.
Well, she's not doing the bloody polling.
It's defiant, is it? Just give it a big push.
Well, you mentioned The Americanization of Emily, and we are doing, in conjunction with Before Midnight coming out, our top 5 Americans abroad. Huh. And in doing some research, that's a movie that came up, and you throw in Paddy Chayefsky, and I'm the biggest fan of Network, so that's all I really need to know, that he's involved with that movie, and it's one I do plan on seeing before doing this top 5. So I hope I have a similar reaction to you.
Oh, my God. And what I found just amazing about The Americanization of Emily is Julie Andrews. Like, she is just a revelation.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because she's sort of prim but sexy, and it's a black and white film, and it's about D-Day. And, I love it.
Well, I can't wait to finally see it. We're wrapping up our conversation here with Robert K. Elder, the author of the new book, The Best Film You've Never Seen. Reading one of the interviews, and I won't say who it was just yet, I was really struck by the fact that that director in particular was someone who I would love to read their film reviews. You know, when you sit down with directors, sometimes it's hard for them to articulate what makes a great film. They make great films oftentimes, but how do they actually describe what they're looking for in a movie or what makes a great movie? It's very different than just actually doing it. Was there anyone for you that you sat down with and after having the interview, after going through it and editing it for this book, that you really said, that person would make a great critic?
Yeah. Well, again, 2 people.
Okay.
One is Edgar Wright, talking about the super cops. And Edgar's just a great talker in general. But hearing him sort of deconstruct this weird 1970s, you know, cop film that is just now actually out on DVD, but it's sort of, before it was really, really tough to find. I had to get it like on VHS somewhere. when we did the interview. But he and then Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
Danny Boyle is so good. And he picks this Nicholas Roeg film called Eureka with Gene Hackman and Rutger Hauer. And just hearing him, again, just talk about film makes you love it even more.
Both are great picks, but not my pick.
Okay, who is it?
For me,
it
was Todd Solondz.
Oh, really?
Talking about The Honeymoon Killers. I really loved his insights into that movie and how in-depth he got with it. You could tell it was something he really thought about. And he talks about how he had just seen it recently and was reconsidering it in preparation for the interview. But I really did feel as if he's someone who could deconstruct movies all day long, and it would be a blast to listen to.
Yeah, and he has this really unique sort of outsider perspective as well. You know, he's had successes, and then, you know, each one of his films is independent, so each one is a little bit of a struggle. So I think he identifies not only with that community, but also with the protagonist of The Honeymoon Killers.
The best film you've never seen. It is available now. Where do listeners find it, Robert?
Amazon, and if you're in L.A. on June 26th, Wednesday, June 26th, I'll be at Book Soup, and Stephen Kyoto, who directed Killer Clowns from Outer Space, is going to be there in conversation with me.
Nice, because that is one of the choices in the book.
Yeah, Brian Herzlinger picked that.
The last question for you is, what's next? Do you have something you can share with us? Because I'm always envious of your ideas. I wanted to do something like the film that changed my life. Then you come up with this great idea. Surely you've got something else great in the works.
I mean, I do. It's sort of unformed, and I don't know if it'll have to do with film, but the book I did before these film books was called Last Words of the Executed, which is about, you know, what people say before they're put to death. And I think it's only natural that I've done death. Now I need to do sex. So the next book will probably be about sex in some way.
Can't wait. Hopefully we'll have you back on for that as well, even if there's no movie connection.
I will make
sex
there be
sells.
A movie. I will
sex
make there
sells.
Be a movie connection.
Robert, as always, so great to have you on the show. We'll talk to you later.
Adam, thank you.
My thanks again to Rob. Always fun to have him on the show. His new book, The Best Film You've Never Seen, 35 Directors Champion the Forgotten or Critically Savage Movies They Love, is available now. More information about the book is available at bestfilmneverseen.com. Coming up a little bit more with Robert Elder, we talk about his previous book, 2011's The Movie That Changed My Life, 30 Directors on Their Epiphanies in the Dark. Find out the single movie line that inspired John Waters' entire filmmaking career when Film Spotting returns. Stay with us.
So you say you're onto something and you'd like to see it through, but you work to the bone and there's only so much you can do.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar. Josh Larson is off this week. Who would have thought a good little girl like you could destroy all my beautiful wickedness? From The Wizard of Oz, of course. And it's the single line that director John Waters credits for inspiring not just his career, but his entire life. In the last segment, we heard writer Robert K. Elder talk about his latest book, The Best Film You've Never Seen. Back in 2011, Elder and I talked about his first book of conversations with directors, The Movie That Changed My Life. John Waters is one of 30 directors Elder spoke to for the book. I started by asking Rob if he was motivated to write the book as a kind of tonic after the emotionally taxing work of his previous book, The Last Words of the Executed.
You hit it on the head, actually. It was the antidote to Last Words of the Executed. And that project took 7 years, and it basically asked the central question, if these are the most reviled outcast members of society, why does it remain a cultural value to record what they say? So it wasn't a political book. It just was trying to understand the ritual and what we can learn from it. And while I was working on that book, I was also working on this book because it's really hard to spend that much time with death and those narratives. And my first love has always been film. I mean, I work for Premiere Magazine. I work for the Chicago Tribune. I do film stuff, every once in a while for MSNBC.com. So this was a real refuge from that project.
Well, when I first saw the book, I think I got an email from you about it, and we were reconnecting after meeting. And when I first saw it, the film that changed my life, I think I opened the package or I opened the email and I said to my wife, I hate Rob Elder. How did he come up with this? This is such a perfect idea for a book, such a simple but elegant idea that I can see a lot of people, including myself and a lot of our listeners, being very interested in. So how did you come up with the idea to talk to 30 directors and have them talk about that film that changed their lives?
Well, it's sort of a focal point of my life and career, which are epiphany moments. So I don't know if last words are epiphany moments, but they sometimes can be. And I also run a pair of websites. It was Over When, Tales of Romantic Dead Ends, and it was Love When. So it's when you know your relationship isn't going to work out and when you know you're in love. So I'm just fascinated by life-changing instants. And because, again, my first love is film, it just made sense that I would want to find the movie that, you know, made John Woo want to become a director, or Danny Boyle, or Kimberly Pierce.
You mentioned some of those names. How did you go about choosing the directors for this project? Because there was at least one, I'll confess, Brian Herzlinger, who I was not familiar with at all, but he's got a great story about his love, and he really does worship this film, E.T., and its director, Steven Spielberg. So he is a great choice to talk about that film.
Sure. Well, it was a mix of things. There's no sort of central driving philosophy. I just wanted to find people who are passionate about film. And Brian did a great documentary called My Date with Drew, which is basically him trying to get a date with Drew Barrymore. It was a film made, I think, for under $2,000. But there was no sort of like, I want to interview just auteurs, or I just want to interview old studio guys, because I talked to Arthur Hiller, who directed Love Story and Silver Streak and a couple other great films. I just wanted to find people who were chatty.
And that's important.
Yeah, yeah. The other requirement was they had to say yes. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the reason this project took 5 years is it is amazingly – well, it's just impossible to pin down directors. Some of these guys I chased for years. The first person who said yes is not even in the book.
Who's that?
Peter Jackson.
Really?
Yeah. He said, oh, yeah, I would love to. Yeah, but great. And then I waited for him to finish the last two Lord of the Rings films, and then King Kong, and then The Lovely Bones. And I think we just exchanged Christmas cards now.
Any dream directors other than Peter Jackson that you weren't able to land, or you maybe had on the hook but weren't able to finally reel in?
Yeah, Terry Gilliam. I'm a longtime Terry Gilliam fan. And in fact, he's in the book, at least in part, Richard Kelly, who directed Donnie Darko. For him, the film Brazil was the film that changed his life and made him want to be a director. So Gilliam, just because if you've ever heard him be interviewed, his just lust for film and filmmakers and filmmaking is great. I'm probably going to try again, because we have connected. It's just that finding time. Scorsese is another one.
Yeah.
But almost everybody else, you know, and the great thing about this is, you know, I would contact people and often you don't do it through their agents. You know, you find some other way, because those people are put in place to protect their clients' time.
Mm-hmm.
So you find more personal ways to do that. And what made the project catch fire really is directors recommending other directors. In fact, it was Kevin Smith, who I know pretty well. He said, yeah, you know, you need to talk to Richard Kelly. Richard Kelly loves Brazil. Why don't you talk to Richard Kelly? And so it was sort of a game of telephone.
Uh-huh.
Again, not all those lines connected, but it was great.
Absolutely. When you can get a nice connection like that from Kevin Smith. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with Rob Elder about his new book, The Film That Changed My Life. And one thing that gets mentioned a few times throughout the book is that there was competition for films.
Yeah.
Not surprisingly, there are some landmark films for a lot of these same directors. They had these films in common, and some people had to go to option 2 or option 1B. What was that process like?
Well, do you want to guess what the two most...
Well, I know it was Fellini's 8.5 was a big one, isn't a surprise.
Yeah, and I think Gilliam probably would have chosen 8.5. In fact, he's on the Criterion disc talking about 8.5. But the two big films are 8.5, which I think Kimberly Pierce, who ended up talking about The Godfather, who she says it's an equally important film to her. And then the other one, believe it or not, is Raising Arizona.
I was a little bit surprised, not completely, because I adore that film as well. Yeah. And I can see why people would respond to it the way Jay Duplass does and others. But yeah, you still don't think of Raising Arizona on par with The Godfather or 8.5.
Yeah, and I think Joe Swanberg was the other one who also loved Raising Arizona. And in fact, we did a whole interview that I think will be on the website about Raising Arizona, but it kept coming up. Not only that, but... Edgar Wright, actually, who directed, Scott Pilgrim and,
Hot Fuzz.
Hot Fuzz.
Shaun of the Dead.
And Shaun of the Dead. His first choice was Raising Arizona. In my book, he talks about An American Werewolf in London.
Right.
At a certain point, it's like choosing your favorite child. A lot of these people, they experience films that it sort of wells up in them. And then they're like, okay, this is my path. So a couple of them, I'm glad they had B and C choices.
Ed rejoiced that my lawless years were behind me and that our child-rearing years lay ahead.
And then the roof caved in.
Ha! I'm barren.
At first I didn't believe it, that this woman who looked as fertile as the Tennessee Valley could not bear children. But the doctor explained that her insides were a rocky place where my seed could find no purchase.
A film like Raising Arizona is one that a lot of these filmmakers probably were able to watch when they were young.
Yeah.
It's a family-type film versus something like The Godfather, which maybe they had to see later in life. And you really do get the sense from a lot of these directors you talk to that the hooks were put in them early by a film they saw when they were 8, 9, 10, or 11, and they couldn't shake it.
Yeah, and I think that's true for most of us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, when we're teens, there's something that turns us on to cinema. And not just, movies, because I think my first movie that I remember is Cinderella.
Wow. We are in lockstep here.
Oh,
it's
really?
Me too.
Really?
Cinderella.
Oh.
Actually, first movie I ever saw in a theater.
In a theater.
I've told this story before that I remember we had a family friend come over and said, hey, I'm going to take Adam and Melissa, my sister, out to do something fun. They can either go roller skating or they can go to a movie. And I chose Cinderella, and we went to see Cinderella.
Yeah. And there are many worse films to have, be your first film. But, the one that made me a cinephile, the one that made me really fall in love was Reservoir Dogs, which I, saw in 1992 or 3 on video.
Me too.
I think the more you get... directors, younger directors especially, their life-changing moments did not happen in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think Richard Kelly told me he watched Brazil in the...
USC, the basement.
Yeah, basically in the basement in front of a little terminal.
Right.
So these things can happen anywhere.
Yeah, and Ryan Johnson recounts a similar story talking about Annie Hall seeing it at USC in that basement. Yeah, it's interesting. And some of the choices... don't surprise you. You've mentioned some of them already. When you see them, even if you're just looking at the outside of the book and you see some of the choices that directors came up with, you say, well, yeah, of course Edgar Wright chose An American Werewolf in London. If you've seen Shaun of the Dead, you can recognize that sensibility. Of course Danny Boyle chose Apocalypse Now. Jay Duplass, when you see Raising Arizona and you think of the Duplass brothers' films, that one fits right in there as well. But were there some that were surprises for you that you never would have thought that director would pick that movie?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. George Romero, who we all know as, director of zombie films primarily, picked The Tales of Hoffman, which is an Archer's film about an opera. It's literally an opera filmed. Again, he's had a really interesting career as well. He started making films for Mr. Rogers, those little industrial films in Pittsburgh. But he's always been a lover of opera and music. And so this was the one that made him want to become a filmmaker.
Hmm.
John Waters on The Wizard of Oz is just one of my favorite.
It's
one of the sweetest... slash scary films. I think there's not, many people who aren't afraid of flying monkeys. But he was so funny about it and just such a general affection. And one of my favorite quotes from the book, it actually landed on the back cover, this single line, quote, "Who would have thought a good little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness?" And John told me, he said, "Sometimes I say it to myself before I go to sleep like a prayer."
That chapter really is one of my favorite because I love Wizard of Oz too. I mean, who doesn't? But hearing the way it impacted John Waters, and then you hear a line like that and you realize, wow, it really does mirror his work in some ways. You can recognize that that impulse and influence.
And it keeps popping up in his films. Mm-hmm. You know, like there are references where characters will be reading the book or it impacts fashion in some way.
Right.
So it's not just that it made them want to become a director, but you can see references to it throughout their entire life.
Well, one that stuck out to me a little bit, you mentioned Kimberly Pierce and The Godfather, just because obviously The Godfather was a hugely influential film and deservedly so. But you watch Boys Don't Cry or even Stop Loss and they're kind of these small films. You don't think of something as grand and sweeping as The Godfather being the film that would really impact her. But then you read the chapter and you realize that, no, what was the thing that really attracted her was that kind of family unit, that small little group, and then that outsider kind of being introduced, and you realize, wow, it does make sense, actually.
Yeah, that's what her two films are about. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. And again, somebody like passionate, articulate, and again, just surprising. That was the thing that sort of kept me going on this book.
Richard Linklater was another, I'll say, that he picked Raging Bull, another film that you expect to have a huge influence on filmmakers. And not that he's not a visual director, watch Waking Life or a lot of his other work, but you think of a movie like Slacker and it being just a talky movie. He makes a lot of talky films, and something, again, as sort of grand and cinematic as Raging Bull, I wouldn't have necessarily made that initial connection.
Right. Well, and not only that, but you find out that, you know, he's an athlete. And in fact, when, you know, the boxer played by De Niro accuses his wife of infidelity, that you know, Rick was telling me, like, no, I totally believed
him. He related to
it. Yeah, I totally thought she was cheating on him, which is, again, you know, that character, it's supposed to show how delusional and how paranoid he is.
Yeah.
But it connected with him in such an interesting way. I actually have a friend who has what he calls the Glenn Ross test.
Uh-huh.
And that is if he's going to date a young lady and they set through a Glenn Ross and she doesn't make it through or she just doesn't like it, they're not meant to be together.
Yep.
And that was the case for a lot of directors. You know, John Waters told me about another film that he loves called Boom, which is just unwatchable. And that's his test. For Linklater, it's Raging Bull. You know, he went to that film with a date and he sort of left the theater transformed.
Yeah.
And she was sort of annoyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did really respond to that as well. I responded to a lot. I made my own personal connections to a lot of what these filmmakers were saying. But that one in particular was one I remember seeing Raging Bull for the first time on a screen with my eventual wife. Mm-hmm. We were just dating at the time, and she is not a big fan of movies that are that graphic, let's say, and really that are that kind of in your face with violence. And certainly she wasn't a huge fan of Jake LaMotta getting punched all the time.
Yeah.
You know, just
all sound design. That's such
awful.
An amazing film. Yeah.
And so she didn't enjoy it the way I did. But the way he summed up how he wants a woman to respond to Raging Bull was exactly how my wife responded and how I would want, which she said, OK, I recognize that that's your thing. I'm not going to trash it. I didn't love it, but I recognize that you like it and that's fine.
He's hurting him now. He has LaMotta on Clear Street holding on. Well, certainly that was one of the most damaging evidences of punching that you have seen in recent years.
There were some obvious questions you had to get out there for everybody. When did you see the films? Some of the nuts and bolts stuff. When did you see it? What impact did it have on you at the time and kind of what the circumstances were? But what I liked is that you do recognize pretty early on that you clearly did your research. You do probe these filmmakers for some insights and come up with some good bits of ephemera here that I thought was intriguing. How much research did you do and how many times did you watch these films?
A lot. I mean, I watched each film at least three times, if they had a commentary track especially. So I would listen to the commentary track. I would watch the film, and then I would do research and then watch it again. You know, little things where I'm talking to Danny Boyle and I said, well, you know, we're talking about performances. And I said, and, you know, people notice that Harrison Ford's in it, you know, just a post Star Wars Harrison Ford. But what a lot of people don't recognize is that his name tag says G. Lucas, you know. But yeah I mean, a lot. And that comes from my love of interviews. On the back of the book, Lawrence Grobel, who was a longtime interviewer. He did the great Brando interviews and the Capote interviews for Playboy. So, sort of my idol. And he just did, you know, he did
like I think like 9 months of interviews, 9 months of research before he interviewed Brando.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's only polite, you know, just to go into an interview really, really prepped. So I love the Playboy interviews, the Paris Review interviews, and it's a little presumptuous to hope for this, but I want this book to be in those traditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious whether your reaction to some of these films changed as you revisited them, either positively or negatively. You realize, man, this director's right. This film's absolutely brilliant, and I didn't give it a fair shake before. Or you said, you know what, this film really isn't as good as maybe I thought it was.
Actually, Rian Johnson on Annie Hall.
Really?
Yeah. Annie Hall is a film that I actually love, and I didn't think I could sort of love anymore. And just doing research about the characters and some of the criticism, and then having read some of the Eric Lax interviews with Woody Allen, mm-hmm. about it, just made me appreciate it all that much more. And it's not often big sweeping things. It's like little things. Like there is so much cut out of Annie Hall. You know, there's supposed to be this like legendary reel of outtakes with Woody or Alvy Singer in the film and Shelley Duvall's character in the Garden of Eden. You know, it just made me even sort of more hungry for the film, and also more in love with that character, Alvy Singer, because one of the critics that I had read basically said it's not that the relationship isn't successful. It's a successful relationship because at the end he's able to appreciate her,
mm-hmm.
which is what he couldn't do at the beginning of it. I mean, and that's sort of a simplistic reading of it, but doing research and then sharing it with somebody who loved it as much as I did really deepened my love for it.
Yeah, Annie Hall, one of our all-time favorites here on Film Spotting in our pantheon. And actually, that's a great transition. Rian Johnson has been on the show a couple times, and back when he was on the first time, I think back in 2006, we did a segment called Film Spotting University, where we shared the movies that we thought, hey, basically, this is film school. If you're an aspiring filmmaker, these are the five movies you absolutely have to watch. And one of Rian Johnson's picks was Annie Hall. Why don't we go ahead and hear that clip of Rian talking about Annie Hall?
Well, Annie Hall for me is the great modern American comedy. And in terms of a film that is both a great film in terms of the technique and innovative in terms of the narrative use of time in it and just everything involved in it, and yet is absolutely hilarious and poignant and just cuts you to the quick in terms of a heartrending story. It's a beautiful film. And The Apartment, I feel exactly the same way about. But Annie Hall won. You win, Woody.
Again, Rian Johnson here on this show talking about his love for Annie Hall, the movie he talks about in depth with Robert Elder in The Film That Changed My Life. And another one that really stuck out to me was Edgar Wright talking about An American Werewolf in London. That's a film that I saw once back when I was probably about the age that he saw it. I was relatively young, and maybe I was just too scared by the werewolf aspect of the film, but I thought it was a cute kind of film. I liked it, but it wasn't one that had a huge impact on me. And then you hear Edgar talk about it with you, and I'm convinced I have to rush out and go see this movie immediately that I was really missing. This is a real work of art.
Yeah, yeah. And not only that, like the way he experienced the film in this sort of media-saturated culture, even, you know, we think about how saturated we are now with images and sounds and even trailers. We see most of the films we see in the theater, we've already seen half of because of the trailers.
Right.
You know, Edgar had already seen most of the transformation photos in Fangoria and those type of magazines, and he already had all these expectations of it. But and I'm sure he would have been fine all the way through the film, but his parents turned it off. You know, they were sort of shocked by it. But the same was true. You mentioned Brian Herzlinger as well. He had seen so many images from the card set of E.T.
He had stills from the movie, and he was disappointed they weren't in the film.
Yeah,
he talks
about. Yeah. Like there's a scene that everybody knows about that is not restored in the restored version where Harrison Ford plays Elliot's principal.
That blew me away as well. Yeah. I had no idea. I mean, just the thought of that, and that goes back again to his role in Apocalypse Now. You mentioned the fact that he's wearing G. Lucas on his name tag. There's some great bits of Harrison Ford trivia that come up in this book. I was really surprised by both of those. I did want to ask you about, just in general, as you went through, did you notice any patterns start to develop in the way that they talked about these films? What jumped out at you that really seemed to be the most significant aspects of the transformation? What was it about these films that really hooked these filmmakers?
In general, there were two types of encounters, I guess, with the film. And one is, that is amazing. I want to do that. The other type of encounter is, if this is a film, I could make a film.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
And Kevin Smith is like that as well. You know, he saw Slacker. Again, it's a nice little bit of serendipity that Richard Linklater, who directed Slacker, is
in the book.
And then Kevin Smith talks about Slacker. But yeah, those were the two solid trends.
Mm-hmm. One that really jumped out for me, and this certainly isn't a surprise when you think about all of these people went on to become filmmakers, but they really seem to pick out movies that struck them for the first time as this movie was directed by someone.
Yeah.
You know, Bonnie and Clyde gets talked about. Some of those films from the New Hollywood that come up, but even Raising Arizona, even American Werewolf in London, these films that you can definitely see a director's hand at work. And it's not just a Hollywood production mm-hmm. that anybody could have done. Up to this point, a lot of these filmmakers were just going to films and seeing them as one kind of mass uniform thing. And then all of a sudden they realize, no, there's some artistry behind this. Of course, Coppola with Apocalypse Now is another example of that, where these filmmakers finally realize, no, someone's actually pulling the strings here.
Yeah. And somebody mortgaged his house and almost bankrupt his family in the terms of Apocalypse Now. You know, that's the same thing for me. You know, again, the film that changed my life that made me want to write about film was Reservoir Dogs. And it was the first time that I sensed like a director's like DNA mm-hmm. in the film. You know, there was a real force of personality about the film. And I think that's what a lot of people respond to when they find whatever that film is that just sort of turns that switch in their head.
Mm-hmm. The other one that jumped out to me a little bit as an exception to that rule, and I'm sure there are others throughout, but the one that really stuck out was Pete Docter, mm-hmm. the Pixar director, talking about Paper Moon.
Yeah.
Peter Bogdanovich. I know Rian Johnson is also a big fan of that, and it influenced his film The Brothers Bloom as a mm-hmm. con movie. But Paper Moon, you have the Bogdanovich film, where Pete Docter, what really stuck out to him was the fact that it's all about the character and it's all about the story, and that Bogdanovich as a director seems mostly invisible. And that's what he really responded to. And then you think about the films he's made with Pixar and what Pixar does so well, and that does make sense. That's what they put that emphasis on, the fact that other directors in that Pixar universe can make these films, but they all have the Pixar stamp because they're all focused on story and character.
Yeah, well, and in fact, it sort of gave me some insight into how Pixar makes films.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Pete Docter directed Up. He won the Oscar for Up, and he also directed one of my favorite Pixar films, which is Monsters, Inc. How he encountered Paper Moon was while researching films for what would become Monsters, Inc.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really, really interesting because basically they wanted to find a whole bunch of not buddy films, but you know, an older person paired
right.
with a kid,
yeah.
which is also what Up is. It's really interesting,
it is.
You know.
Yeah.
At the time that they were considering, you know, they were shaping the script, the character of Boo in Monsters, Inc. Was a much older, much more verbal character.
Mm-hmm.
And so Addie Prey, who is Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon, was the model for that.
Then if you ain't my pa, I want my $200.
Okay.
I want my $200. I heard you through the door talking to that man. It's my money you got, and I want it.
You just hold on a second.
I want my money. You took my $200.
Will you quiet down? You hear?
I want my $200.
Hold on. Just hold on.
I mean, what he loved was this sense of absence.
Yeah.
Which I don't think you can say about all Bogdanovich films.
No.
I think he is a force of personality, but it's a sacrifice made to the material.
No, I think that's absolutely fair, but it does stand in contrast to some of these other films, especially A Clockwork Orange gets
yeah.
talked about in Brazil.
Yeah.
We've mentioned them. These are films that you think of as so hand-in-hand with their directors and their personalities and their visions
yeah.
that then to have one director say, you know, what I loved about it was that I felt like it wasn't directed by anyone, that
right.
it was just about the story that occurred to me throughout. I guess I do want to end here, though, by going back to Reservoir Dogs a little mm-hmm. bit, because you talked about, surely, as you're going through this, that was one of the things I was curious about is, okay, what about the author? What were the films that changed his life as you were going through this and hearing some of their stories? What movies popped into your head? You've mentioned Cinderella, Reservoir Dogs. That's kind of the infancy of your cinema
yeah.
love, going to the one that really sparked an interest in film being something that you wanted to do
mm-hmm.
in some way, that it was going to be a part of your vocation. What about some of those movies in between? Were there some that really stuck out?
I think the whole summer of 1982 sticks out, you know, but basically, and I think we're reminded that of that this Christmas, which is, you know, Tron popped back up.
Right.
So that summer, just like some of the most seminal genre films of all time, you had The Wrath of Khan, Blade Runner, Tron, E.T., The Thing, all of which I was too young to see, by the way. But somehow, you know, as I discovered them later, really sort of shaped my love of films. And also, when we talk about a film that changed our lives, usually we talk about a film that taught us something about other films.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally we'll run into something, and the last time this hit me, and it hit me hard, it teaches you something about life or character. And the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind did that for me.
Mm-hmm.
And because to me, that the ending of that film basically says, we may be basically incompatible. You know, we may be in love,
right,
but we have the capacity just to make one another miserable because we're not fundamentally compatible. It is still worth all the pain and trial and risk to still find that out. It's still worth it to go through a romance to find that out.
Yeah. And I can see that having a huge impact, one of our favorite films here on the show as well. Some of the ones that occurred to me, and we'll mention it now for the seventh or eighth time, but Reservoir Dogs really was. It was the movie, and sometimes I've said I feel almost guilty about talking about it because it's kind of a cliche of a cinema geek to mention Tarantino. But I saw it just like you. I think I was 17 or 18. It had come out on video. I, at the time, was not following what was happening at film festivals. Yeah. I didn't know who Quentin Tarantino was. I think maybe the person I watched it with who introduced me to it said, oh, yeah, actually, that's him, the one who can't act here in the film. He's the guy who wrote and directed this. And somehow, even without knowing anything about Quentin Tarantino, you watch that movie and you just recognize early on that it's like something you've never seen before. That conversation at that diner, I had not seen in a movie up to that point. And again, it was fairly early in my cinema education, but I hadn't seen anything like it. And you recognize that there's somebody's hand at work, and I just became fascinated by it. And it not only made me want to see what he was going to do next, but it made me want to see the films that influenced him.
Right.
And I started becoming a cinephile, I guess, because of Quentin Tarantino and Reservoir Dogs. That movie is what made me start collecting films.
Right. Well, and it's so easy with Quentin as a director because he is sort of like a mashup artist. He really is. You know, he takes pieces from all over. But for me, and I'm not going to give this away for people who have not seen the film, there are two just things that I got sucker punched by in the film, and one is the reveal of who is the undercover cop,
right,
which is just, you know, amazing, and for my 17-year-old self was just mind-blowing. And the other is when that undercover cop is learning to be an undercover cop. There's this whole great sequence where he's learning to tell basically a story that will convince them, you know, the people he's infiltrating, that he is a, you know, that he's one of them.
So I walk into the men's room, and who's standing there? Four Los Angeles County sheriffs and a German shepherd.
They're waiting for you?
No, it's just a bunch of cops hanging out in the men's room talking. When I walked through the door, they all stopped what they were talking about and they looked at me.
That's hard, man. That's a f-ing hard situation.
German shepherd starts barking. He's barking at me. I mean, it's obvious. He's barking at me. Every nerve ending, all my senses, blood in my veins, everything I have is screaming, take off, man. Just bail, just get the f*** out of there. Panic hits me like a bucket of water. First there's the shock of it, bam, right in the face. And I'm just standing there drenched in panic and all these sheriffs looking at me and they know, man, they can smell it. Sure as that f*** dog can, they can smell it on me.
Shut up.
And it's just amazing.
It is.
He's telling the story. He's learning the story. Then he's inside the story. And then he's inside the story telling the story. really, that scene, there's nothing else like that scene in cinema history, like that I can think of that pops to my head. So I will also have to say that I chased Quentin for years trying to get him in
this
book. Yeah. So if Quentin, if you're listening, please call me. there will be a sequel. Yes. So I would love to have his thoughts in here.
Yeah, that scene is actually one that's been played and talked about on the show because I agree with you. It had that same impact on me. A few others that I just jotted down, and longtime listeners of Film Spotting will be familiar with some of these titles because they've come up before. And in fact, when we did that Film Spotting University with Ryan Johnson, one of the films that made my list was Blue Velvet. Mm-hmm. That was a film I saw shortly after Reservoir Dogs. But it was really my first kind of art house experience. Yeah. It was something that – it was so rooted in something conventional. It was like a film noir. It was a detective story. It was a mystery. And yet at the same time, you had all this wacky David Lynch stuff going on with Dennis Hopper and Dean Stockwell and you know, Isabella Rossellini. And then somehow by the end of it, it just made so much sense to me. It really did, even at that age, 18 or 19, whatever, it did just connect with me in some way. And it made me realize that film didn't have to be so damn straightforward.
Yeah.
You could have that kind of absurdity and surrealism. That had a big impact on me. And another one is one that comes up in the book a little bit, and I think it's Kevin Smith who talks about it, and that's Hal Hartley's Trust.
Yeah.
That's a movie that I was in film school when I saw that movie and instantly basically just started copying Hal Hartley when I made short films.
Oh, yeah.
Because it had that impact on me, the arch kind of dialogue, the style of it, the heightened sense of the dialogue was something that I hadn't really seen before as well, and stuck out to me as something that could be done. Ed Burns was recently on the show, and I talked to him about The Brothers McMullen. Mm-hmm. That was my slacker for Kevin Smith. That was the film where I saw The Brothers McMullen and said, okay, I don't know if I can write a movie that funny and that good with characters that I like that much, but he made it for $25,000, yeah, and he shot it pretty simply, and I think I could do that.
See, and I'm a minority. I actually like his sequel, which is She's the Woman.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a much better film. In fact,
yeah,
I had a hard time, like, why did Brothers McMullen win Sundance? But then there's a lot of weird films that win Sundance, like What Happened Was. Have you ever tried to sit through that?
No, I've never seen it.
Okay,
no,
do that.
Not at all.
Everybody out there, go to Netflix.
And it won Sundance.
How? How? I mean, the thing is, but it's weird. It's got Tom Noonan in it, and it's sort of, again, lovely and weird and like, how?
Yeah.
But anyway, it's one of the reasons, again, this book is not sort of a definitive book on what you should love or see or whatnot. It's just a chance to get conversations started.
Right.
So, I mean, many of these conversations, mostly I, you know, when I pitch the project to directors, I just say, hey, listen, if you have 30 minutes for me, you know, sometime in the next 6 months, you know, I'd be in your debt. A couple of these guys I was on the phone with for 3 hours.
Really?
Because they just, you know, they didn't actually have the time, but they love talking about film so much that, again, I was changing tapes 3 and 4 times.
Wow. Well, that energy and passion comes through, obviously, throughout the book. It's great hearing these filmmakers talk about the movies that change their lives. Great having you on to talk about the ones that impacted you. Hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Adam, thanks for having me.
That was my 2011 conversation with Chicago writer Robert K. Elder. The follow-up to Elder's The Movie That Changed My Life is out now. It's called The Best Film You've Never Seen. 35 directors champion the forgotten or critically savage movies they love. Up next, the two hosts of Film Spotting reveal the 5 forgotten or critically savage movies that they love. That is, we love. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Hi there, listeners over at the Film Spotting Mothership. This is Matt Singer from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And in our latest episode, Allison Wilmore and I look at the new season of Arrested Development and see if it lives up to the original or whether Netflix has made a huge mistake.
And once we've pieced together the new episode's complicated timeline using elaborate charts and graphs that don't really translate on a podcast, we're going to talk about other cult comedies out there on streaming and VOD sites like Hulu, Netflix, and more. To listen, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes or go to filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughan. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, and a show that started with my conversation with writer Robert K. Elder about the films that directors like Richard Linklater and Guillermo del Toro chose as their favorite critical or commercial failures. We decided to end the show with a top five from May of last year when Josh and I shared our favorite overlooked movies. One that didn't make my list, for reasons you'll soon hear me explain, was 2010's Never Let Me Go.
Why didn't Tommy get the ball? Excuse me, Miss Busy. Why didn't Tommy get the ball? When it bounced over the fence, it couldn't have been far from him.
The fence is the boundary of the house and grounds.
We don't cross at the boundary, Miss Lucy.
It's too dangerous.
Dangerous?
There was once a boy who had a big row with all his friends and then ran off beyond the boundary. They found him 2 days later in the woods, tied to a tree, with his hands and feet cut off. Dead.
It's time for the Film Spotting Top 5. This week, our top 5 overlooked films, specifically overlooked films that we could see someday, if it ever happens, that we have our own Film Spotting Festival. These would be overlooked gems that we really want to share with a large audience, movies that were basically underappreciated or maybe just didn't get the attention they deserve fully. And you just heard a scene from Never Let Me Go, which is a movie, Josh, that came out in 2010, my number one film of that year. It certainly got enough attention from me, but in terms of box office, was a clear failure. It only made $2.5 million domestically and seven more international. $9.5 million sounds okay until you look at the fact that the budget was $15 million. So this was a box office failure, unfortunately, but again, a film I adored. And if it wasn't for the fact that it was just recently on a Film Spotting Top 5 list and a movie I've talked a lot about, it would be my number one overlooked film that I'd love to share with an audience. And we considered a few other things as well as we formed these lists.
Yeah, for me, it's going to be a recent list because I looked at my top 10 lists for each year going back to 1998. That's when I started those and kind of plucked titles from there that I felt were forgotten. Mm-hmm. And my definition of overlooked is kind of unseen given their industry expectations. So if it's an indie film, you know, the expectations may not be huge, yet it might not even have met those. So that was sort of my guidelines.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that we definitely both considered is who would attend from the film to help make
right.
it a little
yes.
bit more special. That's a big part of Ebert Fest. We talked about Jeff Nichols and Michael Shannon being there, what they added to the discussion of Take Shelter, being able to run things by them and just hearing their perspective on the making of the film and the response to it. So considering who we might be able to invite was something that was a factor, even down to the fact that, you know, we're not going to talk about a movie from 1945 that nobody has heard about mm-hmm. if everyone involved is no longer with us. These are, for the most part, kind of recent movies that we could still see bringing these people and shedding a little bit more light on their work. So with that, what's your number five?
I'm going to start with Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I considered it.
Did you? Good.
Yeah, I did.
Good. It's from director Edgar Wright, and it's based on graphic novels from Brian Lee O'Malley. It follows the misadventures of a Toronto teen, played by Michael Cera, who gets into these superhero-style battles with romantic adversaries. It's a lovely portrait of teen narcissism, I thought, and always proceeds kind of with this understanding that we were all once self-obsessed kids. So it's a very affectionate portrayal of that sort of mindset. Now, it not only embraces the graphic novel format, but I thought Wright really one-upped it for the screen. When Scott plays his bass, big, bold letter Ds kind of pump across the screen. Mm-hmm. There's another moment where a character who's frustrated, her face becomes a frowning emoticon. So it really has its own unique aesthetic.
Scott Pilgrim!
Hey, buddy!
Save it! You're pretentious. This club sucks. I've got beef. Let's do it.
Wait.
You want to fight me for her? No. I want to fight you for me.
Scott earned the power of self-respect.
I'd love to have Brian Lee O'Malley come and talk about this and see how much the movie got what was in his head, because it felt like to me it was everything.
Scott Pilgrim was an honorable mention for me because I looked at the box office and saw that it definitely didn't make its money back. And that's unfortunate because I'm a big Edgar Wright fan and I didn't love that movie as much as I would have liked. I probably gave a little bit more of a mixed to positive review. But the fact is, it's on HBO and has been for the past couple months. And I was just telling my wife 2 nights ago, this is endlessly watchable.
Yeah.
I may not have loved it as much as I wanted to in the theater, but on HBO, every time it's on and I come past it, I'm glued to it watching it.
And the reviews were part of the problem, too. It wasn't just box office, but it was underrated by you.
Yeah.
And a lot of critics. I was really surprised how many people kind of just waved this one off. I mean, not that everyone has to agree with me, but there were really very few positive reviews for a film that made my top 10 list that year.
Well, it is a good pick. As we get to my number five, I want to throw out a couple movies that won't make my list that I definitely considered. Can't even really call them honorable mentions, because the fact is, when Sam and I, former co-host Sam Van Halgren and I, went to Ebert Fest back in 2005 for the first time, we were only 9 episodes into Film Spotting then, which is pretty remarkable when you think we're now on episode 396. Yep. But that was episode 9, the Overlook Film Festival. We did our top 5 Overlook films back in 05, and I didn't want to rehash that same ground, but 3 movies that I definitely would consider: Roger Dodger, the Dylan Kidd film with a great Campbell Scott performance; Cradle Will Rock, Tim Robbins movie. I love this film way more than most people do, and that was a big box office loser. And an old Billy Bob Thornton penned movie, I believe, the Carl Franklin directed One False Move.
Oh, yeah.
Is a really good thriller that I think I could see at an Overlooked film festival. And I also excluded any movie that's been a Film Spotting Golden Brick winner. That's our annual Golden Brick Awards, where we shine the spotlight on 5 or 6 movies and then pick a winner that we thought was overlooked from the year that really stood out for us. So The Arbor from last year, Dogtooth, Moon from Duncan Jones, and Rian Johnson's film Brick, 4 other great overlooked movies but aren't going to make this list. So my number 5 is a film that I saw back at Sundance in January 2007, and it was my favorite film of the fest. I wanted to make sure I got at least one comedy in here, and it's the movie Son of Rambo, directed by Garth Jennings, written by Nick Goldsmith, Hammer and Tongs. People probably know them better as from their music videos and such. And it was actually one of the big buys of the Sundance Film Festival. I think Paramount Vantage paid $7 million for it. I don't know what its overall budget was, but it only made $1.8 domestically. It really came and went, unfortunately. And I even feel guilty because we didn't talk about it on the show in the summer of 2008 because so much time had passed. But it's the story of a kid named Will who comes from a very strict religious family. He can't watch films or TV, and he develops a friendship with the school troublemaker Lee, who has a video camera. And they decide they want to enter a competition, a filmmaking competition. They're going to make their own movie inspired by the fact that Will, this sheltered kid, finally sees first blood when he's over at Lee's house, and it changes his life.
Boy, what's Lee Wolf doing in my costume?
He's driving the Jeep for the getaway scene.
Yeah, but I'm Trouman, I'm driving the Jeep.
You can't drive.
It's Peter Piss.
Don't be stupid.
All right, then. Well, if I'm not needed, I'll be taking my camera back, then.
You promise?
Yeah. And what do you know about promises, love brother?
Don't push it.
Yeah? You need to grow up.
You drew first blood, and you're a head case.
It's really funny, but there's some great dramatic elements as well with Will and his dealings with his mother. That relationship's really interesting, but it just captures that sense of imagination and wonder that a lot of us have as a young boy, becoming obsessed with a movie or a piece of pop culture and how that can change you. And I think if I had seen this as a kid, it definitely would have inspired me to want to pick up a camera or get into movies even earlier than I did. It's a really sweet film, Son of Rambo.
And the sweetness is there, so you wonder if that was a failure of marketing, because I could have seen that one be a Billy Elliot-type hit.
Absolutely.
With the heartwarming aspect. Yeah. I mean, it's well done, too. It's not mushy and sappy, so that is curious that that didn't find a bigger audience.
Hmm.
My number 4, I'm going to Spike Lee's filmography for Bamboozled. It's another Spike Lee grenade, and while not all of those are necessary, a lot of them blow up in his hands. I think this one was dead on in 2000, and it's really still needed today. Damon Wayans starred as a television producer who creates a modern-day minstrel show. He's hoping to get fired, but what happens is America goes into this craze for blackface.
Boom, baby, boom, baby.
It makes you get your freak on.
Clinical testing has found that Viagra doesn't work on black jocks. That's why our scientists has developed the bomb for you. It makes you feel like a man, yo, and it makes them feel like natural women. I mean, ho.
It makes my nature rise.
I want to get funked up.
So really provocative stuff. I took it as sort of a searing indictment of misogynistic rap groups, buffoonish urban television sitcoms, as well as the audiences of all sorts of demographics who mindlessly consume this sort of stuff. Now, how much was Bamboozled ignored? It's 2000. Keep in mind that in 2000, Tyler Perry had yet to hit the big screen, so that might put it into perspective a little bit. I'd love to invite Damon Wayans, actually, to talk about this film, because I think it'd be really interesting for him to look back now and place it in his career and see where he might have been involved in some of the very things that this movie was satirizing.
Well, I'd have to recuse myself from that part of Film Spotting Fest because I had a very tough time with that film and Damon Wayans' performance in particular. It's a movie that I really appreciated its audaciousness. I love what Spike Lee was going for in terms of the execution. Didn't work for me at all. But then again, at that time, I wasn't writing reviews or really considering films deeply. Didn't really wrestle with it, but it didn't work for me on that first viewing.
It's really aggressive in your face.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. There are some really funny satirical moments in it, though. And it seems like for our number four picks here, we decided to both court controversy a little bit and deal with race as well. My number four is the Craig Brewer film Black Snake Moan, starring Samuel L. Jackson and Christina Ricci. It's another film I loved at Sundance 2007. Before Brewer made Footloose, one of my least favorite movies of last year, we had high expectations for Craig Brewer because of Hustle and Flow, and he didn't disappoint when I saw the premiere of Black Snake Moan in 07. Sam Jackson plays a religious farmer. He's an old bluesman, and he finds a troubled girl played by Ricci. She's been beaten up in the road by his house, and he decides that he's going to help save her by chaining her to his radiator. And now you can maybe figure out why this movie lost $4 million or so at the box office and nobody went to see it. But watching this film, I touched on it when I mentioned Samuel L. Jackson and how much I didn't like him as Nick Fury in The Avengers, because I was thinking of how good he can be in a movie like Black Snake Moan, where he's playing not a badass, but a deep, complex character. And I give Brewer a ton of credit because it's a really tough act for a director. When they have a main character we're supposed to find sympathetic, or at least empathize with, who's doing something really reprehensible that we cannot agree with on any level, and here you have two characters behaving that badly in Samuel L. Jackson and Ricci, he somehow pulls it off that we do care about these characters and care about their redemption as it all plays out. In terms of who I'd invite, obviously Craig Brewer, Samuel L. Jackson would be essential, Christina Ricci as well. And the one scene in particular I'd love to talk to them about is the big performance scene that happens in the movie, where Samuel L. Jackson finally straps on a guitar for the first time in a while. And I think the music scenes in this film in general are just really powerful. The whole thing is kind of directed like a great blues tune, where there's kind of quiet, gritty moments, but then it also gets really loud and rebellious. I'd love to talk to them about shooting that scene.
Wanted me some kids. I'll mess up. If Rose, my wife, kids is for another time. I seen the change in her. Breast started swelling up. A couple of mornings I hear her in the bathroom throwing up. I done seen it in other women before, so I knew.
Black Snake Moan, that was a very volatile film. I think a lot of people just kind of wanted nothing to do with it, so good for this list. My number three is The Weatherman. It's my choice for the best movie of 2005.
No kidding.
It was. It's an understated effort from two names who we usually think of as going big: star Nicolas Cage and Pirates of the Caribbean director Gore Verbinski. It's a character study. Cage plays a Chicago meteorologist who's a well-meaning but consistently disappointing divorced father of two. The Weatherman is one of the most effective voiceover narrations I've heard. I'm usually really suspicious of those. It's a confessional one by screenwriter Steve Conrad, sort of this running commentary that's constantly going in Cage's head. Visually, Verbinski makes this really interesting, actually, even though it's a character study. He kind of focuses on the slushy and frigid Chicago that we all know and endure. Yet this thing went nowhere, even for a smaller Hollywood film. It only made $12 million in the U.S., and it didn't get any Oscar attention at all. There's one scene here that always comes to mind with this film, and it's why I'd want to invite Steve Conrad, the screenwriter, to be the person to talk about it. Conrad also wrote and directed The Promotion, you might know, the John C. Reilly and Sean William Scott comedy, which was actually my number one film for 2008. So
wow.
I'm pretty impressed by
Are
Steve Conrad.
Are you on
Conrad.
Steve Conrad's payroll?
I am not. I've been pretty impressed with him, though. I'd love to have him come talk about the tartar sauce sequence in The Weatherman. This is when Cage's character is sent to go pick up their takeout food, and his wife, who he's been bickering with, this was pre-divorce, They've been bickering together, and she just tells him, don't forget the tartar sauce. So he walks out of the house, and we hear in his head, tartar sauce, and then jumping in are all these other stream of consciousness thoughts. And of course, he's going to forget the tartar sauce, but it's just this kind of reminder that shows us how scattered and how faulty his mind really is.
And that's a movie I like and think it was definitely underrated, but didn't love it clearly as much as you did. It's one I'd like to see in repeat viewing and having Steve Conrad there. And come on, let's get Nicolas Cage as well, please.
Yeah, I guess. I'm just so curious about that voiceover narration, how he makes it work so well. I'd love to hear that.
Tartar sauce, tartar sauce, tartar sauce. Tartar sauce, tartar sauce, tartar sauce, tartar sauce. Man, I'd like to put my face in there. Right in there. Tartar sauce. My hips are cold. Tartar sauce. That's when you know it's cold. What happened to the guy who was trying to go around the world in a balloon? Did he make it? I should put some espionage or stolen plutonium in my novel. Tartar sauce. Spice it up. Neil Young. F*** it's cold. Neil Young. Why am I thinking about Neil Young? Neil Diamond. Neil. There's not a lot of famous Neils. Is this Wednesday?
Well, you're listening to Film Spotting, Adam and Josh sharing our top five overlooked films, and more specifically, five movies that we'd each love to share at a Film Spotting overlooked film festival. We think it'd be great to have an audience, give these films a little bit more exposure, a little bit more love, and also have some of the people who made the film participate in some Q&As and talk about the movies. And my number three is the Richard Linklater movie Fast Food Nation that came out, I think, 2006. I'm not sure about its budget, but it only grossed $2.2 million domestic and foreign, not a whole lot. It's based on Eric Schlosser's investigative journalism book, Fast Food Nation, obviously nonfiction. Linklater takes this book and makes it into a fiction film with this huge ensemble and these overlapping stories. And it manages to walk this really fine line where it's activist filmmaking in a lot of ways. It's trying to get you riled up about things. It's trying to make you want to make some kind of change in how the world operates, especially this industry. But at the same time, I don't feel like it's overtly political. It never gets as preachy as he could. The characters are never just mouthpieces for Linklater or Schlosser. They talk like characters you'd expect from a Richard Linklater film. It's very much a film, not just about the fast food industry, but about the American dream in general. And I love the fact that Linklater does something really bold with the film, which is he basically says, you know what, if this bugs you, if you want to make a change, you're going to have to be the one who does it. There's not going to be some movie character hero who's going to come along and save the day and make this all okay. It had a really profound effect on me when I saw it. I remember no one really cared about it, got a lot of middling reviews. It blew me away.
What was strange about that one, too, is there was a lot of expectation for it because Schlosser's book got a lot of attention.
Right.
It was Linklater. And yet, after it came out, it just kind of disappeared.
Yeah, so, it did. And maybe that's the Linklater approach. It doesn't work for everybody. I'm a big fan of most of his films, and obviously it'd be great to have Linklater there. It'd be great to have Schlosser there as well and talk about the changes to the book. If I was going to pick one scene to focus on, it'd be when Greg Kinnear, one of the main characters, meets with Bruce Willis, who I think is only in the film for one scene, but he plays the bigwig, a vice president at the fast food chain Mickey's. And it's just a good example of how the film doesn't get too preachy and not too predictable, because you expect the Bruce Willis character to be a certain way and for the scene to play out a certain way, and it ends up being a lot more nuanced and layered than that. And it really does make you realize that this notion that, you know, if you don't like fast food, you don't like how they're treating the animals or whatever, you don't think it's safe, you just want to stop eating the fast food, don't give them your patronage. This scene really shows you that that is one thing, but that really isn't helping all the people that are employed by this industry and who are hurt by it and affected in a variety of ways. So it just speaks to how complex the book and film both are. So Fast Food Nation is my number three overlooked movie. Josh, what's your number two?
Number two is probably the biggest movie on my list. It's Beloved. When Beloved came out in 1998, expectations were really high. It was based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel from Toni Morrison. The stars were Oprah Winfrey and Danny Glover. Jonathan Demme was directing. So there were obviously even Oscar expectations surrounding this film. None of that panned out. It got a Best Costume Design nomination only. The tale here is full of sorrow. It's the story of an escaped slave who's haunted by her horrible past in more ways than one. It works as a ghost story, really. And I think part of the problem might be we like to think of slavery in this nation as over and done with and mostly forgotten. If we're going to deal with it at all in the movies, we'd somehow like to make it inspirational in an odd way. You know, think about how Glory fared a lot better at the Oscars about a decade earlier. I think Beloved was just too dark, too messy, and too aware of the lingering fingers of slavery that are still with us today to kind of resonate with something like the Oscars or major audiences. It'd be really interesting to hear, I don't know if she's ever done an interview about this, but what Toni Morrison might have to say about why Beloved, the movie, never really resonated the way the book did, because the book found those audiences. I don't know if it's just a format thing, but I'd like to hear her take on that.
Beloved's so overlooked. I haven't seen it. I never did catch up with it. So,
yeah, settle in for a rough night, but you got to see it. Yeah.
Well, you're very persuasive, Josh, with that. Speaking of movies that are also going to give you a little bit of a rough time, there's no doubt about it. This is pretty harrowing subject matter. It's the only documentary on my list at number two. And we go from the biggest movie on your list to the smallest film on mine. It made all of $80,000 at the box office. Obviously did not get much of a release, though. And it's a film called Enemies of the People. It's a British-Cambodian documentary that's written and directed by Rob Lemkin and Tet Sambeth. And Tet is a man whose family was killed during the Khmer Rouge, during the killing fields, basically, time in Cambodia from 1975 to 1979. And he decides to try to tell this story, to try to tell the stories of the people who passed away, in some ways figure out what happened to his parents. And it's not so much about seeking some kind of vengeance or trying to bring people to justice. It's really about just trying to supply some answers to something that everyone knows about and everyone knows it was horrible, but no one really knows the specifics. No one really understands why or exactly what went down. And that goes for the people of Cambodia. And so I really love the kind of mission he seems to be on, even though it's unspoken, I think, largely throughout the film, which is he's just trying to put together almost some kind of factual, hard and fast historical record so the people of Cambodia now and in the future can really wrestle with and understand what happened in the late 70s in Cambodia. And the key to this film is he develops a relationship, and I'd say it probably even develops into a little bit of a friendship with a figure who is known as Brother Number Two. He was basically Pol Pot's right-hand man, and he goes to him. He opens up to Tet and gives him a lot of information, but Tet never tells him, or at least holds back for a long time, that his family was murdered as well. And so that's a little bit of the tension and a little bit of the drama you know is going to come to the surface at some point in this movie. So I was really moved by this film. It's really powerful stuff, really well made. Obviously, as I said, a noble effort. And I think the two filmmakers, Lemkin and Sambeth, would be great to have at a Q&A. And if I was going to ask him about one scene in particular, there's a moment where he goes and talks to a guy who he knows was involved in the killing. It's not Brother Number Two, but was involved in the murders. And at first he says, no, I didn't do anything. He really tries to downplay it like he didn't do anything. And Tet just keeps hammering him and hammering him and eventually gets him to not only reveal all he did, but there's one really harrowing scene where he basically demonstrates how he would kill people on another guy who's there. It gets really kind of graphic in that way, but it's something that probably needed to be told, needed to be revealed. It's Enemies of the People, and it's hard to find. You can't get it on Netflix or various rental places or streaming, but Amazon does sell it, and also iTunes sells it if you want to buy it and stream it through there.
Well, you haven't seen Beloved. I've never heard of Enemies of the People. So yes, Overlooked, definitely. My number one, I'll try to lighten things up a little bit. Not only is this underrated, I have yet to find anyone who agrees with me on this film at all. So maybe I'll hear back from a few supporters of Monkey Bone. Now, Monkey Bone got 20% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, a 40 out of 100 score on Metacritic. If you don't remember Monkey Bone, it's the story of an animator, a cartoonist played by Brendan Fraser, who ends up struggling against his own creation. So it's this wild combination of live actors, stop motion animation, puppets, computer generated effects, all at the hands of stop motion specialist Henry Selick. Selick is the director, the actual director of Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, of course, and he also did Coraline. This actually ends up being a really funny demonstration of how our interior angst can be put into the service of art. Bizarre art, but art nonetheless.
Hiya, Stu.
Hello.
Jimmy! I brought you a refill.
I'd love a stiff one, but Stu here forgot to endow me. Whip me.
Nothing for him. He's being repressed.
And I don't know if it's just a thing of not hitting other people's funny bones, and it did hit mine, but it's actually a really delightful film. I love it, and I will continue to defend Monkey Bone. I'd like to have Henry Selick up on the Q&A to give me a little support on that. I just love to hear about his craft because I find it so fascinating.
Is Monkey Bone a film I could watch for the first time, I might add, with one of my kids?
Well, that's part of the problem is no.
It's not a family movie.
It's not, and that's how they sold it for whatever reason. It was sold as a family film. It was marketed that way, and I don't know if, you know, the word got out that families went and got out what it was. I mean, it's nothing like horribly raunchy, but it's not meant for kids at all.
All right, Monkey Bone is one I definitely have completely forgotten about and, as I mentioned, haven't seen, so a great pick. My number one is appropriate, I think, considering we were provoked to do this list by Roger Ebert and EbertFest and how he picks overlooked movies to give more attention. And the big reason why we went down to EbertFest this year, I would have gone probably anyway, but I really had to be there because of the screening of Take Shelter and wanting to see Jeff Nichols and Michael Shannon talk about it. And that brings me back to a movie that is still definitely overlooked, even though talked about a little bit here on the show over the years, and that's Shotgun Stories. Jeff Nichols' debut feature film is from 2007. It's a simple story, kind of like Take Shelter is. It's about a feud between two sets of half-brothers after their father passes away. It takes place in rural Arkansas. Michael Shannon's kind of the leader of his set of half-brothers who were actually named by their father simply Son, Boy, and Kid. And they have a lot of animosity towards their dead father because he was not a good man and went off and started this new life and seemed to turn over a new leaf. And the key scene that I would love to have Jeff Nichols and Michael Shannon there to talk about is the one that sparks this entire feud, which is where Michael Shannon decides to stand up and say a few words at his father's funeral.
I couldn't let you marry this man without saying a few things first. You all are here because you think this was a good man, but he wasn't. Just because you stopped drinking, call yourself Christian, get a new life, start a new family, that doesn't make you a different man. This is the same man that ran out on us, that left us behind to be raised by a hateful woman. He made like we were never born. That's who this man was. And that's what he's answering for today.
Shotgun Stories from director Jeff Nichols, my number one overlooked movie from our May 2012 top five. His latest film, still in theaters, I hope you don't overlook, is called Mud, starring Matthew McConaughey. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting. Out in wide release this weekend, The Internship. This is Google Crashers, basically Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson are 40-somethings who turn to internships at Google. The Purge is out. This is a movie about a family held hostage for harboring the target of a murderous syndicate during a 12-hour period in which any and all crime is legalized. Lena Headley stars, as well as Before Midnight star Ethan Hawke. In limited release, Deceptive Practice, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay, the famous illusionist, author, and actor, regular featured guy in the work of David Mamet. That looks like an interesting documentary as well. You can see Joshua Tree, 1951, A Portrait of James Dean. That's exactly what it is, a drama about the life of James Dean as he was on the cusp of achieving fame. You can also see The Kings of Summer, a comedy about three teenage friends who decide to spend their summer building a house in the woods and living off the land. Next week on Film Spotting, Josh and I will be back in our regular format. And no, we won't be discussing any of those movies because, as we promised previously, we are going to get to, finally, our discussion of Richard Linklater's latest, Before Midnight. We'll also share our top five Americans abroad. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, an American who was just abroad at the Cannes Film Festival in France. He'll be back here on Film Spotting for his regular monthly visit. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. More information about Robert K. Elder's Best Film You've Never Seen at bestfilmneverseen.com. Our featured music this week from Archie Powell and the Exports. Learn more at archiepowellandtheexports.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.